You're listening to The Winston Marshall Show with me, Winston Marshall. It is my pleasure today to speak with Stephen Shaw. Stephen Shaw is data scientist, demographer, and filmmaker, maker of the film Birth Gap. We are going to discuss what I have understood through his film is not, in fact, the fertility crisis that the world is facing, but the childlessness crisis. And Stephen, you're here in London. I think you've been at the ARC, you've been in the House of Commons discussing the future of demography for Britain and the world. I want to get into all of that, into how we can deal, what policy we can do to change the current trends, what can be done about it. But before we get into all of that, I was wondering whether we could go into the crisis itself. How, for people who don't understand the childlessness crisis, who haven't yet seen your brilliant film, which I've very much recommend that they watch and is available on YouTube, Stephen, how can people, what do they need to understand about the childlessness crisis facing humankind?
Yes, well, there's 2 points there, and thank you for inviting me, Winston. It's a true pleasure to talk about this subject, and it's my passion. It's become my life journey, unexpectedly, because I had no idea the level of low birth rates. Let's start with low birth rates before childlessness. I had no idea how widespread low birth rates were when I started making the documentary or researching for it back in 2016. I thought it was isolated to societal issues within Japan or within Italy or Spain. And no one seemed to be thinking of it in terms of a global trend. But when you looked at today, lots of people are looking at it. Thankfully, people are more and more aware of this. This is happening everywhere. Now, you can say, well, Africa is an exception, but it's actually not. Africa is on the same path. It's just quite a few decades behind the rest of the world. But we've got rapidly falling birth rates across much of Africa, too. 70% of people on the planet now live in a country that's below the replacement level, as demographers call it. I like to call it the tipping point. Mm-hmm. That's when, on average, parents are having two children that reach adulthood. So it's around 2.1 children per mother is the way it's usually expressed. 70%. Now, the reason this is frankly scary, it is scary because there's no known example of a country during times of prosperity that's come out of that cycle once it's in low birth rate territory for some time, a decade or longer. And, you know, there's isolated examples after famines, after wars. But those were times when there wasn't societal change, that life kind of reverted to the way it was before. This is different because life in all our countries has changed or is changing in a rapid way. So low birth rates, I'm sure we'll come on to the consequences and why that's such a crisis. To me, it's the crises of all crises because we don't have a solution. Other crises, I think we've got mitigating things that, you know, whatever your views on other crises, you know, we can sit down around the table and have a discussion about which solutions may or may not be appropriate. When it comes to birth rate decline, there are no known solutions. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty scary. Now, you introduced it correctly as a childlessness crisis. People don't know that. I didn't know that when I started researching. Even demographers today still often don't know this, but no one had been looking across all these nations in terms of family structure before. And I can say that because otherwise I wouldn't have had to go on this journey. I wouldn't have had to spend all this time doing this detailed research down into low-level data. But what you find is that if you take Japan, the average family size and structure, meaning the number of people having one child, two, three, four, up to eight or 10, that has not changed since the 1970s. In fact, it's barely changed since the 60s for mothers, fathers too, I guess. But we can't, women, we always talk about data relating to women, and it's just because there is lots of data around women, but obviously it's meant to. Now, let me just give you a poignant example. In 1973, 6% of Japanese mothers were having four or more children. Mm-hmm. Today, that's exactly the same. No change.
So the change is that the mothers having only one child are now having no children, and then the
not necessarily. No, and that's a really good point to explain as well, because it's actually not that. What has happened is an explosion in childlessness. So back in the 70s in Japan, but also Italy, much of Europe, UK too, childlessness was less than 5%. It exploded within 3 years to 20-25% and then settled at over 30% in Italy and Germany and Japan. All these countries, despite their diverse cultures, their differing economic situations, went through the exact same trend at the same time. Mm-hmm. And there are no exceptions to this. So you made the point, was it women who were having one were electing to have none? No, it turns out that's not the case because the distribution of family size didn't change. If that were true, you would find less people having one child. You'd have a shift towards larger families because those who have fewer children or want fewer children would be electing to have less. And we don't see that at all anywhere. It turns out this whole crisis is caused by delayed parenthood. It's caused by what I call unplanned childlessness. Most of us think, certainly I did, that the majority of childless people either had some medical issues or chose not to have children. It turns out that's completely untrue. The vast majority, around 80% in countries that went through this transition decades ago, we can say around 80% of those people had planned to become parents. Mm-hmm. So why are the people who are planning to become parents not becoming parents? Well, that's a big topic. But what happened in the 70s across Europe, in Japan, and has now happened in South Korea, in the US, in Malaysia, in Costa Rica, the trend to start families in our 30s has really become the norm. And what happens in your 30s? Well, we don't know what happens in our 30s. We may or may not have a partner. We may have had a breakup, a divorce. That happens a lot. Mm-hmm. We may get tired and think, you know what, I don't really want to be raising kids when I get to my late 50s. I should have done it earlier. Or clearly, fertility issues kick in probably quicker than most people realize. Mm-hmm. So the whole crisis is caused by the shift to delayed parenthood. Mm-hmm. This is consistent in every single country I've researched. And global low birth rates are unquestionably driven by this. And this alone, because family structure hasn't changed.
So I've seen this with the ONS data. And one point that you've made in your work again and again is that if you are childless at 30, there's a 50% chance you will be childless forever. And according to the ONS data, it's now Britain, over 50% of women are childless by 30, and that comes out at their childless 18% at 45. So that's part of that kind of consistent with what you're saying. What I kind of want to understand is that's you're making the point that that's a statistical observation, and that isn't obviously you're not destined. If it's not a 50% chance, that could be turned around if we manage to turn around the situation.
Yes.
Nothing
is written. But as a statistician, you look for statistical evidence. Uh-huh. You look at countries where there was a recovery of significance for a period of time, and there really isn't anything. Yeah. But could it change? Sure, if more people in their early 30s perhaps become aware of this, and I hope they will, whilst they still have a chance. So, and the statistics from the ONS are consistent. Could I just say, though, that the classical way to measure childlessness is to wait until a woman's 45, because for the individual, there's still some hope at age 45. So that's what demographers have done. What I do is look at the rates of motherhood. And the reality is, to put it this way, the chances of having a family at 44 are slightly higher than 45. 43 is slightly higher again, but the chance of having a three-child family at 43, 44 is near zero. In other words, you can actually model this and you can actually say, wait a minute, we see now a large bubble of women who are childless, late 30s, early 40s, the likelihood of more than 10%, 5% becoming mothers, we can define that. And hence, we can define what the current wave of childlessness is. My point is the 18% you say for the UK right now is going to go up. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely going to go up. It's going to go up to at least 25, 26%. And I can see it going up to 30, 33%.
So let's go into some of the reasons for that. And I also, one thing that's interesting about your film was that a lot of the statistics and the way this was written about is it's the pressure seems to be on the mother, or it could be interpreted that the pressure seems on the mother, pressure is on the mother. But what was interesting about your film is that there are a few examples where it is actually the fathers who hadn't grown up, who didn't want, you know, who were putting back, who wanted to continue their party lifestyle, who weren't embracing adulthood.
Yes.
It seems. So that seems like that's one of the issues. But then you also make the point that there was the oil shock in 1974, which kickstarted the problem in Japan. I would say at the same time, 1969 was the Divorce Act, 1967 in the UK, the NHS made the pill legal. All of these things seem to have happened at the same time, around also a culture of the you know, contemporary feminist culture, that onus on having a career first and foremost. So there's a whole bunch of things happening.
Yeah,
simultaneously.
Yeah.
That it's not as simple as saying, oh, there's only any one reason. But what do you think are the sort of salient ones?
So it was certainly a time of change. For me, though, data is wonderful if you can look at different countries going through the same experiences at the same time and mm-hmm. look for similarities and differences. So if you look at the US, for example, you do see a very similar trend in 1971, actually before Japan and before Europe, childlessness in the US went up to around 15-18%, and it stayed around that level. There was other things going on. Like the population bomb, the book came out. There's a lot of media coverage. Paul Ehrlich. You know, so there's a lot of things going on in the early 70s. There's what's called the Nixon shock, which happened in the US when economically there were challenges. Those may have all been factors. But if you look at the US, childlessness didn't get anywhere near as high as Japan or Europe. It actually stayed relatively low throughout all the... Now, I think a society can be stable, given we know that the majority of people, vast majority actually, want to become parents. That's consistent everywhere. Mm-hmm. If a society has around 15% childlessness, it can have a stable population because parents typically want 2 to 3 children, somewhere between 2 and 3. So that balances out really quite nicely. That's where the US was up until the mortgage crisis shock, another shock, 07, 08, when there was a turning point within the US. These financial shocks seem to be the things that transform societies. Mm-hmm. My point being that even though the US went through all of the things you mentioned, you know, increase in divorce, you know, the contraceptive pill, the rise of different waves of feminism, et cetera, it still had a very nice balance in demographically up until 07, 08. So I look at that period for the US to say, that's what I think we should aspire to, getting back to around 15%. If we can do that from a purely mathematical point of view, and I'm sorry to bring mathematics into this, but to have a stable society, if we're going to plan for our pensions and our futures, you know, as most people, you know, I think would want to do, if you're minded to live not just you but future generations in a stable society. So all of those changes happened. We're not going to reverse them, I think, easily. It's not like we're going to flick the switch back. And I believe in women's education, careers, etc. We just need to make things more flexible. To me, that's what it comes down to, so that people can have children at the time they choose, rather than having to pursue a full training, a full education first, and then establishing a career first, and then having a child becoming the last thing on the checklist when you're 33 and suddenly you don't have a partner.
Have you looked into that mentality of why women feel that pressure? Why is there culturally that pressure to tick all those boxes before having children? And why isn't there the idea of trying to do both simultaneously or starting earlier? What do you think is going on there in the cultural change?
Yeah, and I think, you know, let's be clear. I mean, I don't like separating men from women in this context. I think as societies, we put pressure on everybody to get an education, on everybody to establish careers. It's what we do. And probably for good reason, in the sense that, you know, we compete against each other. We compete against our peers. We compete against other countries, as nations, as companies. So, of course, you want to get as educated as anybody else. Of course, you want to establish your career as much as possible. The answer to that question for me, however, lies in what we're not telling people. We are not telling men or women that the fertility window really is really quite short compared to what you think. And I can give you some stats on what people think. You know,
let's have the stats.
Well, you've made the point that, you know, it comes from my data research across all of these countries that only half of women turning 30 without a child ever become mothers. Now, technically, they can have had a doctor, say, well, wait a minute, technically, it is possible to have a child after 30. Of course, it's still possible, but other things happen in life, but back to not being ready, trying to get to a certain point in your career, having a partner in the first place who also wants a child at the same time. Things go wrong, you know, based on a life plan for too many people. So why are we not educating people in college, high school textbooks, secondary school textbooks? We tell people about how not to get pregnant. You know, but we don't tell people, by the way, there is this window. Mm. So for me, from a societal point of view, we're encouraging people to get an education. That's a good thing. Encouraging people to get some level of independence, autonomy, perhaps. But we're completely absent in this message of, by the way, you also might run out of time to find a partner that you want to have a child with and have the family you want. I think if we introduce that into the conversation, priorities might change.
I actually think it's worse than that, Stephen, because not only are we not mentioning it, there's been big movement. We mentioned Paul Ehrlich earlier with the population bomb, that there's also the antinatalist crowd, the environmentalist crowd saying there are too many people. We need to have fewer human beings to save the planet. It is, I mean, at its extremity is a genocidal movement, but it's a popular one. And that narrative, even though there are outspoken, famous outspoken people taking an opposite view. Elon Musk is an obvious example, Hans Rosling, yourself. Nevertheless, that idea, particularly pushed by the environmentalists, seems to be getting a lot more airtime and has convinced our young people more convincingly than the idea that we need more humans.
Yeah, they have commanded the conversation really up until the recent years. And to me, there can be nothing more selfish than any person telling somebody else not to have children or to have fewer children. Mm. Paul Ehrlich, who was interviewed for 60 Minutes in the US this year, I think he's 91 or 92 now, so he's still going. And he was sitting in a very nice location, dressed well. He lives in the most expensive state, I think, in the US, or one of. And he made the statement that if the rest of the planet is to live like Americans, like him, we'd need 5 more planets. And where are we going to get those planets? I mean, that is the uttermost selfish thing. If you really believe that from an environmental point of view, so I'm not doubting he believes that there's an environmental issue, mm-hmm. but if he believes the solution is other people not having children, instead of him downscaling his life or telling people to do that and balance the number of people, it's a very dark place. Now,
that's an excellent point. If he really believed that, he would be downscaling.
Yes.
Instead, no, he's going to continue consuming and tell others how to behave.
Yeah, and maybe he has downscaled. I have never met him personally, but there's certain things that raise eyebrows, and certainly the messaging that they put out. Now, there's other organizations, and some of them, maybe many of them, are well-intentioned. But I think in behind these organizations, perhaps the founders, perhaps some donors, are what I call pretenders. They have their own agenda. And, so for example, there's one in the UK and their slogan is have fewer children than you want.
Who's that?
That one is Population Matters. Now, they probably do a lot of good work because they have a lot of environmentalists trying to kind of save, creatures around the world associated with them. So I'm not labeling everybody. But if you say have one fewer child than you want, I ask them, what should people who only want one child do? And they didn't answer. One of their supporters came in on Twitter and said, no, it would be morally wrong to tell people to have no children, but they haven't answered that. Now, the reason we can say with certainty that these organizations at their core are ideological is that they're not saying to countries like South Korea, which has got a horrendous 0.8 birth rate at the moment, or Japan or Italy. They're not saying, you've done enough now. Well done. We can see your population is going to come down by half or even more. They're not saying to the UK, you know, you're on the right path, another decade of this, and then we can balance things out. They're not telling countries how to ultimately stabilize. If we don't stabilize this, civilizations end mathematically. Mm-hmm. And that happens a lot quicker than we might imagine. So all of these organizations, there's another one, population balance. If there's a word population in the title, very likely they're an organization that is driving one thing and one thing alone, which is keeping us in the path that will ultimately end civilizations, period. So they've had, and they've been very clever, because they keep switching. So in the 60s, 70s, Paul Ehrlich was focused on scaremongering that we're going to run out of food. That was his mantra. He did also mention the environment, but that wasn't his thing. It was, we're going to run out of food. In fact, the UK wasn't going to exist by the year 2000. We're going to run out of, the planet was going to run out of food. That fear led to horrendous things happening. In India, in the early 70s, mid 70s, there was forced sterilization of men. In 1 year alone, 6 or 7 million men were forcibly taken off trains. There's all sorts of, you know, shocking stories about what happened. And
that was the government.
It was government. It was Indira Gandhi, Prime Minister. She was interviewed by Jonathan Dimbleby when she was here in the UK. You can watch the interview when she defends this. And he says, this is just shocking, abhorrent that you're coercing people, you know, incentivizing local officials based on the quota of how many people need to have forced vasectomies. And she said, basically, she had no regrets. She had no regrets. Now, that all links to organizations and funding from an era that was focused on running out of food. But then that didn't happen. The Green Revolution happened. So these organizations, many of them, switched to say, okay, it's an environmental issue. What we should be aware of is they're now shifting, or some of them are shifting, because they know that we're seeing the total headcount reaching a maximum. They've figured out that people are going to realize, actually, we don't need to worry about family size because of the environment any longer, because we're on the way down. Yeah. So it's now the patriarchy.
So they're unreconstructed Malthusians who just keep shifting every time the argument goes against them. They keep shifting it. But actually, what remains consistent is that they're anti-human.
They are. And I think that means some of them are extinctionists. I know that for a fact, because some of them have come out to say that they just want no people on the planet. There's a gentleman called Les Knight appeared in the New York Times talking about his desire that we had 8 billion less people. He wants us to go down to zero. Those people are out there. Other people with that view, I think, disguise themselves. And that's why I call them the pretenders.
So, yeah. So what about the pronatalist movement? Are you a pronatalist?
I'm a pannatalist.
What's a pannatalist?
Well, I came up with the term, so I get to define it. I define it as someone who supports people who want to have children to have the number of children they want to have. So that's akin to pronatalism. But it also includes supporting those people in their right not to have other people who don't want to become parents. And that's somewhere, it's less than 10%. It's probably 5, 6% of people, of women, simply don't have the desire and literally have no urge to become a mother. I support them as much, perhaps even more, because I think it'd be terrible to force people who really don't have a motherhood instinct to have children. So pannatalism.
But you can be a pannatalist because you know that most women want children. If it was the case that most women didn't want children, you'd have to take a different position.
Well, no. You see, when I started this project, I thought that's what I was going to find. Yeah, I thought I'm going to find out that people no longer want children. Confusing as that would be, because why suddenly, after all these millennia, you know, and you look at nature, you know, all species procreate, why would it change? But I thought that was probably going to be the conclusion, that people, for some reason, now don't want children. And I thought the documentary was going to evolve into a story where I was going to be preparing people. Okay, we're shrinking, we're fading out. Here's what we need to think of in these next decades. So I would never put myself in the category of coercing people. Encouragement, yes. But there is a fine line here, and you know, someone's encouragement might be somebody else's coercion. So perhaps it's fortunate, therefore, that I have ended up in the position of finding out the vast majority of people do want children. It certainly makes it a very much simpler argument.
So then what to do about it? If we have both a cultural problem, an economic problem, as you know, the crash of 08 as well as the 74 have exacerbated these trends, and an ideological problem with if it's not popular, at least the antinatalist ideology gets a lot of airtime. How do we shift things? Is it are you a pessimist? Do you think it can be turned around? I mean, you've made the point earlier. It has never turned around. Every time a society has been in this position, there is no example where it's turned the child giving it around.
In this context, I'm a recovering pessimist. I've found optimism, and I didn't expect it. I'm an optimist about almost everything in life. But in this one, throughout the entire time I'm making the documentary, just everything got worse. When you realize the impact on societies, the impact on, you know, taking care of the old is just going to be the loneliness, you know, of the young and old. Wars. You know, instabilities are going to happen that, you know, where leaders look at external distractions to kind of take the mind of the people off the internal strife that they're going through economically. This is not about gliding down to some lower population. It doesn't happen that way. You end up creating what they call these inverted worlds with just far too many older people to support for the tax base.
We haven't gone into that in this conversation, only because you do it in great detail
in
the film.
Yes.
So I think people should watch the film to understand that.
Thank you.
And you've made that very clear there.
Yes.
I'm not sure you're convincing me that not to be a pessimist here.
Yeah.
You just introduced the idea of war, which I hadn't even considered.
Well, that's why they're recovering. I just want to paint just the, you know, where I came from, to the contrast of what I sense now, unexpectedly. From showing the documentary, screening it at universities, to some high school children in the UK, in Japan, in the US, the reaction from young people gives me significant hope. Mm-hmm. And I'll quote Charlie Bentley Astor from Cambridge, who as a young student in the UK watched the documentary, contacted me, invited me to Cambridge. She described that she went through 2 weeks of anger. The phrase she used was that she became haunted by the future she might not have. She didn't know it was 50-50% likelihood at age 30. She thought she had 10 more years before she needed to think about settling down or finding a partner or having a family. And realizing that having just graduated Cambridge, you know, with this fantastic career opportunity ahead of her, she needed to reassess a timeline. Mm. And Charlie's by no means alone. There's a young Japanese woman who watched it and just said one thing to me at the end. She said the documentary changed her life. 22-year-old student. I don't know exactly what that meant, but I sense it was a case of reprioritizing things again. A 12-year-old watched it with his mom and said, "Mom, I just saw my future. Can I watch it again with you?" Mm. I don't think young people... But what do? We tell them, study hard. Mm-hmm. We tell them, get a good career. We don't ever mention the possibility that, by the way, you actually might run out of time to meet a partner, have the family you want to have. The anger and the there's all sorts of words I could use. It's a combination of distress, agitation. Yes, at what might happen. That's the generation that can make a change because they can still change their lives in terms of career, in terms of timing, in terms of priorities. You know, I can't. Fortunately, I had three kids, but it's a case of the fire in the eyes of the younger people who've seen this documentary. And it's not just a documentary. It helps start a conversation. It's just awareness. I think awareness of this issue amongst younger people will be enough on its own to let young people reprioritize their lives if they want to have children, mm-hmm. as the vast majority do. So the optimism comes from younger people driving change And I'll add one more optimism that links to this. In many countries, certainly Japan now, there are so few young people. Employers can't find young people to hire. It's a highly, the power is moving into the hands of the shrinking number of younger people to choose employers they want to work for or to switch jobs more easily than they would have. Mm-hmm. So those employers who truly do make education or truly make career paths more flexible and education paths more flexible too, I think young people can drive change here.
So I can certainly understand that on the individual level, like films like yours and people speaking out on it, giving lectures on it, it's very persuasive and you can understand, I haven't actually got 10, 20 years, I better get on with this, and individuals reprioritizing. But there's another issue, and this is one of the things you've been doing here whilst in the UK, which is a country suffering a birth problem. I think, what is our, I've written it down, our current birth, we are at 1.56 children per woman. I don't actually know what the childlessness at that figure is. We've gone into that in the ONS. It's bad.
Yeah, it's about 26% is the kind of baked in childlessness level for the UK, and it's rising.
26%. Yeah. Wow. But apart from the individual side, you've been speaking to MPs like Miriam Cates, and this topic was also covered at the ARC Forum that you were here in London to attend. And I'd like to talk about the demographic trilemma and ask you about the demographic trilemma, because those in policy who are talking about what can we do about this come against the demographic trilemma. And this is in a report by Paul Morland and Philip Pilkington, if anyone wants to read into it. But if I can just read what the trilemma is, because I'm interested to take your take on it. Yeah. And about what is the best route forward. So there is a trilemma in demography, similar in form but different in content, to the one faced by the unfortunate residents of the former Eastern Bloc. Sorry, this is referencing to a Slavoj Žižek concept of a trilemma. But the trilemma can be framed as a choice of any two of the three things: low fertility, gross domestic product growth, which we can characterize as economic growth, and the absence of rapid immigrations, which we can characterize as ethnic continuity. Choose low fertility and economic growth, and you must have rapid immigration and ethnic change. This we call the mass migration option. Choose low fertility and the ethnic continuity, which requires low immigration, and you are saddled with economic stagnation. If you want economic growth and ethnic continuity, then you must choose more children. Now, my head's kind of going off on a little bit, like particularly the idea of ethnic continuity, and I would probably say it's more about cultural continuity. And if you're bringing in migration, you change, you have competing cultures, and you have civil unrest, as we've been seeing in England. So the ethnic continuity, it seems a problem if it's cultural continuity, if there's a problem of assimilation, but perhaps that's a side point. What's your take on the demographic trilemma? What do you think, is migration the priority? Is maintaining culture the priority? Do we need to encourage indigenous people and countries across the world to have more children? What do you think this trilemma gets right or wrong, or which route would you take?
I think it presents a reality that we cannot maintain growth at current birth rates, and that an alternate option could be immigration. But I want to kind of go a little bit further than that to explain something fundamental about immigration that's different to birth rates. If you were to increase birth rates in the UK, and by the way, a birth rate of around 1.5, 1.6, that means births are going to half around every 75, 80 years. So we're talking of a significant decline over a few generations. Yeah. So that someone who's young today, by the time they're a grandparent, if they're a grandparent, of course, will see a vast shrinking of native-born children. Now, so is the solution immigration? The difference with immigration is it can never, ever stop. If you're to increase birth rates societally, you do that once, you would immediately get balanced. It takes time to stabilize. because you still got some old people, you know, too many old people for a period of time, but it would stabilize. Immigration is, as a policy, means accepting this will continue year in, year out, forever. And the reason for that is two things. Immigrants naturally get older too and need supported. So you haven't changed anything to do with the need to support older people in society. And immigrants, we know by second generation, have the same number of children as the native population. That's what happens. Why? Because they, you know, younger people are, you know, brought into the same education system, the same career system, delayed parenthood kicks in, the same outcome. So you take countries like, say, Germany, which has had relatively high levels of immigration for many decades. Germany's birth rate is around 1.4, 1.5. It doesn't solve the birth rate problem. So you're still left with the birth rate crisis.
Mm.
So what you need to do next year, you need more people. And, you know, as the immigrants get older, you need more people. It never, ever will end.
Mm.
So therefore, it is not a solution in and of itself. It's a band-aid, a sticking plaster. And that's the way to think of it. If you, as a society, want to address this problem and you feel, well, let's try and find a solution, the only solution can come through birth rates. Immigration can then be something to kind of ameliorate the situation in some way for a period of time. You know, for the next 10 years, 20 years, we'll need more workers. And then, to me, as you know, I live in Japan, which relatively speaking has very low levels of immigration, although it is increasing these days. You know, for me, as I talk to people in many different countries, it's up to people in each country to decide what's right for them in terms of immigration policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that gets to the heart of how a nation defines itself. And I don't want to necessarily say, you know, a certain level of immigration is good or bad. What I like about the paper from Paul and Philip is it's introducing this point very poignantly that we will, if we want to maintain the economic standards of the UK, let's put it that way. Some people think growth sounds greedy, but actually we need growth. It's fundamental. But let's just call it economic standards, the way of living that we've become accustomed to in the UK. If we want to maintain that, current birth rates are not going to do it at all. And to put that in context, this year 900,000 people will celebrate their 50th birthday. There are only around 700,000 births a year in the UK now, and that's shrinking. That's a 23, and that's what I call the birth gap. The movie's called Birth Gap. It's a gap between the number of old people and the shrinking, ever-shrinking number of children. So, you know, that gap is there already. We can't see it today because we like to live in urban areas. And when we move to urban areas, we have problems with housing and we have problems with, you know, it just seems there's so many people. That's urbanization. It's a distribution problem. The actual problem that it will eat away at nations and is already eating away at the UK, we can't see it just yet because the UK started this trend a bit later than Japan and Italy, et cetera. It's already baked in and it's absolutely the right thing that we need to be thinking about what the UK is going to, how it's going to function 20 years from now.
I'd say it's more than, it's just a sticking plaster. It doesn't actually quite do it justice to it because there are a lot of problems with mass migration, not just for the country where people are emigrating to, but from as well. Yes. You know, you have brain drains famously, and it affects demographics there as well. So there's a lot of problems with migration. Is it too simple for me to think that if we sort the housing crisis out, that we'll sort a lot of this out? So, for example, how can you expect a young person to want to conserve anything or the system as it is if they don't have a stake in it, if they don't have a place to build? How can you expect them to want to start families if they're worried about rent, if they don't feel like they have a place? If we change that, if we can give young people easier access to a home that they own, then they'll think, oh, actually, we can get on with starting a family. Is that possibly one of the simple solutions, or am I oversimplifying?
This is an interesting one. You know, of all the policies that have been tried around the world to increase birth rates, you we can generalize and say everything has failed. You know, you can look at policies in Japan and Korea, but also Scandinavia, where significant investments have been put in place to encourage people to have more children. And if they work, it's for a short period of time, and then it's kind of a pull forward effect. People, you know, see an incentive. They were going to have a second, third child anyway, so let's do it now. Mm. But after that, the birth rate goes straight back down. So really, in simple terms, nothing seems to work, which is interesting. The one policy that I'm intrigued by, but there isn't enough evidence yet, because it's quite recent, is in Hungary, where they provide a loan to a young couple to start their life together. It doesn't have to be used for a house deposit, but that's the intention. It's linked to family size, which might be controversial. So if you say, I'm going to have three kids, you can borrow more than two kids. And it goes up to four, I believe. And interestingly, if you then have the three kids you said you're going to have, the loan's written off. Mm-hmm. Now, there's been no change to family structure or size in Hungary so far. That might happen later, but there's no increase in three or four child families. But there's a huge decrease in childlessness, which went from around 43% to 28% over a 10-year period. Wow. Now, that's still too short a period of time to be conclusive about this, but it may be the case that, you know, young people in Hungary are thinking, huh, I can actually get the house that I would have wanted to start a family in sooner than otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to wait to my 30s to start that family. And those may well be people who want three, four children, but equally, it might be people who only want one or two. So the distribution hasn't changed in terms of family structure. But it may be the case that housing in and of itself – but I want to share more generally. Putting more money in people's pockets does not increase birth rates. In fact, the opposite happens. So and actually, large family size is more correlated with, you know, having less. You know, poorer people do have.
Doesn't this contradict your theory about the 74 oil shock? Mm.
Well, you see, what happened during the oil shock, all these shocks. So, first of all, why are those shocks so significant, and why did societies not reverse back into their former state after the shock? So, what happens during those times? Take Japan. If you already had one child during the oil shock, you actually accelerated. More people had the second child than had been having a second child before. During uncertainty, I think people with one child were thinking, gosh, this might get bad. Let's have that second child now, because we know, as most people do, want more than one. But people going from two to three, three to four, didn't change at all. There was no change through any of these crises, in fact. But all that happened was people who had not yet had the first child delayed having that child. So, so in other words, it was more a structural change as the timing of having a child. Now, what I mean about so what tends to happen if you have a quick fix of, you know, an incentive, you know, people will often think, well, okay, our times are better now. We're through a recession. Often people think, well, I'll go for a vacation this year, and I'll do the few more things I wanted to do before having a child, because having a child in our 30s is normal. People do that these days, and then many find out it doesn't work out that way. So financial incentives in and of themselves don't work. Housing policies, based on what I'm saying, in Hungary might work, but there's still a big question mark on that.
Okay, so really it's predominantly cultural then.
Yes. No, I want to be clear. It may be a very good thing to have more kindergartens, to have child allowances. In the UK, child allowance stops after the second child, which is just bizarre. I mean, what country would put a policy in place to stop an allowance for the third or fourth child if that's what families want to have? And the fact that happened here, and nobody until Miriam Cates kind of seemed to notice, you know, tells you something about the culture of the country. So I think it is cultural. So all these policies being there may be very good things. Mm. And I think as we start to see, I believe we will see a wave. It might be a small wave, but it might be a big wave of people choosing to have children younger. Mm-hmm. I think policies do need to be in place to make it easier to be a parent in our 20s than today's. So, but there has to be a cultural shift, a mindset shift in terms of, yeah, the timing of when the right time for men, as you said earlier. Yes, a lot of men are still Peter Pans into their 40s.
Yeah, a lot of Peter Pans.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with what happened in Singapore, where so Lee Kuan Yew identified that university graduates were not having children, so he put incentives not just for the general population to have more children, but specifically for university grads to have children as a means to, I guess it's not just the more money you have, but also the more education you have, the fewer children you have, and this probably ties in with your point that you prioritize your career so is there any country that you think has done policy which you're more encouraged about?
Well, I've cited Hungary. Hungary has many other policies, and it may be the case of Hungary that because it's seen within the country as a good thing to have a family culture, you arrive at the airport and there's a little placard saying "Family Friendly Hungary." It's very subtle, but maybe that just is what we need in societies to. Well, actually, Miriam Cates last week in Parliament, in part of the survey she ran, just the vast majority of people in the UK think that motherhood is not, we need to promote motherhood as a concept. We need to be more proud of our mothers, and who wouldn't want to be when you think about it? It's the most important job in life. And so it may be that the smartest thing is simply to culturally, make countries prioritize and proud of their mothers. You ask about countries with policies, though. Japan's just come out with the latest wave of policies. I think it's generally, certainly from my perspective, none of them directly will work. I think governments, when you're at a certain state in the cycle, and Japan is now really going through, the birth gap, as I call it, for Japan right now is up to 60%. So that means there's 60% fewer babies being born than the number of 50-year-olds. So the number of 50-year-olds in Japan is probably around 1.8 million. The number of births now is down to, it's under 800,000. And it's getting worse and worse. At that point, I think governments are just pulling every lever possible to try and see if anything will work. I think this is more about culture. I think it's about awareness. I think young people, including in Japan, once made aware of the reality that they may run out of time and that no one's been telling them.
You're making me a pessimist again. I don't... Earlier, you're recovering pessimist, but you say this. You mentioned war, and I think, okay, this is the end of Japan. Well, we're next.
Yeah. Well, to be really clear, for Japan to get out of this is going to take 50 years. This is not okay. We can have this sorted by Christmas or, well, not Christmas in Japan. Well, there is Christmas in Japan. This is going to take two generations. And part of what I'm doing now, the documentary was step one. It was always going to be step one. Part two is about awareness and solving the crisis. But part of that awareness is to say to young people, this is going to get worse before it gets better. We can't change that, but it can get better. And to younger people who will look at their retirement window 50 years from now, 50 years from now is not that far away. I think if you're young, well, it probably feels a long way away, but it's still an important time of people's lives. And it's not that you have to wait 50 years for it suddenly to get better. It will get worse for a couple of decades. But if you can see birth rates increasing, if you can see childlessness, unplanned childlessness reducing, I think that will be enough to have hope. So that's why I said I'm a recovering pessimist. I'm on that scale. I'm moving back towards optimism, but it's only in the longer term.
There's a new, in researching this, there's a new concept which I wasn't familiar with. Well, but it makes kind of sense when you understand it, is sibship, the idea of siblings and what effects that have. And this is part of the same research paper that I cited earlier from Pilkington and Moreland. Children without siblings experience higher... obesity rates, they struggle with relationships with other humans. There's a whole string of related issues that seem to be a consequence of not having siblings growing up. So I wonder if you had any insight into this problem? Is this one of the other things exacerbating the whole crisis that we're in?
Yeah, and I'm always conscious, you know, when we talk about this, there will be people out there who don't have siblings, and I'm sure many, you know, succeed and are fine in life. But in a general, I mean, there was a survey came out very recently in the US that asked ideal family size, and even those people who had one child did not recommend having one child significantly. And overall, the desired family size, I think it was 3% of people felt a one-child family was a desired family size. You know, most was two or three or more. So I do think that the majority of people plan to have more than one. I'm quite certain of that. And I think that, again, it's life circumstance that, you know, when you're in your 30s, having the first child, you know, is a challenge. But, you know, having a second child is a greater challenge. You know, I know many people who, going through IVF, you know, have only ever been able to manage at best one.
IVF has got a weird, people treat it very oddly because it's seen as something that you can rely on when you get into later years, but actually it's got a pretty low success, it's 1 in 10 success rate or something, which...
Well, it depends on age, but yes, I mean, I interviewed 5 fertility doctors, including Kim Kardashian's fertility doctor for the documentary, and they all said the same thing. It's just our perception and the media, you know, we hear...
And it's expensive. It's extremely expensive.
It's expensive, but what we don't understand, I think, is the hormones that women have to take time after time to go through each cycle, and you're going to go through multiple cycles, and you know you hear horror stories. There's one young doctor, junior doctor, who saw the documentary, student doctor, and he'd been working in an OB-GYN clinic, I think, and he ran after me after the screening of the documentary and said, "I want to tell you something. The way we, you know, just abandon women who have failed IVF, you know, no one knows about the horrors, the tragedies that they're going through." And he asked, you know, you know, can we promote the documentary for people to kind of understand, you know, in the hospital to understand that the chances are acting. You know, you go and see your IVF doctor. I would understand. It's natural for people to be positive. Yes, we can help you. Yes, we can try this. But what the doctors are not really saying, I think, I'm not saying they're dishonest, not at all. It's just human nature. What they're not probably relaying is that the reality is the chances here are probably a lot lower, and that the hormonal consequences may also be a lot more difficult than people prepare for. Egg freezing is another one. It's the big thing now. You know, it's supposed to kind of solve this problem, but there are questions over the efficacy of it. It's still quite a new thing, so I'm not the right person to talk about that. But what I see happening, when I heard of egg freezing, I thought it was the answer. I did. I thought, this is brilliant. We can now have children, and you know, women can have children into their late 30s without too much difficulty, which is clearly not true. But what I can see it doing is encouraging people to delay things further. It's like, oh, I've frozen my eggs. I can focus my career for another 3 to 5 years before I even have to think about settling down. So it's a trap, I think. I'm not saying it's intended to be a trap, but you know, Miriam Cates last week, you know, showed an ad for IVF in London and the subway system, tube system here. And it was like, enjoy life now, you know, while you can, have kids later, basically. And it's like, well, you know, that's a very damaging thing, that the fact that you can't enjoy life once you become a mother. Life changes for sure. But that's just encouraging people to delay parenthood. And the consequences for many, that will lead to, which is not, it's not just being able to have a child. It's having the partner, having the life circumstances, having the energy to have a child. And we overlook that.
The question I want to ask, but I almost feel like I know the answer, but it's, okay, so if you're in your early 20s, the question is, reprioritize, get on with prior to putting a family, looking for a family first. But if you're in your 30s, male or female, it's not, what do you say to someone like that? Because it's not like you can say, settle with anyone. Because that's, you know, getting married to someone is a big deal. And it's not just about having children. It's also the 30 years after that that you've got to spend together. So,
and certainly dating today, it hasn't gotten any easier. I mean, thankfully, I missed the whole era of apps. You know, that's just something that you could actually approach someone and talk to someone because that was the only way to meet someone. And, yeah. You know, you actually developed kind of a connection, I think, more naturally, perhaps. A lot of people today, I'm perhaps fortunate in that not just for making the documentary, I interviewed 230 people for the documentary, but since then, many, hundreds of people have told me their personal stories. People, I think, sort of trust me and come up and tell me a little bit about their situation and even ask for advice. And I don't like giving advice, but there's one or two things I do share. One is that, you have to compromise in something. You will never find perfection. You won't. And the second thing is, what's more important? And I don't know the answer for everybody, but I think people should ask themselves, what's more important, becoming a parent or finding that match that you're looking for? And for many, it might be, well, I want to find the match. The children have to be part of that. And that's fine. At least people have processed that. But for other people, or people in the situation where maybe they're dating someone and it's almost the right thing, but they're not totally sure, I think it's a good point to say, look, if I have kids with this person, does that sound like a good life? Or should I keep looking in the hope that I might possibly find something later? I also, that the culture we have today, I mean, the heartbreaking stories, men and women, but it's usually women who find that they've been with someone dating for 5 years, 7 years, they get to early 30s, and then there's a breakup unexpectedly. And, oftentimes the man has got a 25-year-old girlfriend now. Mm. And several times I've had heard of that, and suddenly there's a baby a year later. And you've got these 32, 33-year-old women. It's like, what happened? We were together for 7 years. We were living together. Everything seemed on course. I don't think dating for that length of time, in the assumption that that person's going to be there to be a parent, in future is necessarily a wise thing to do, frankly.
This ties back into the point I made right at the beginning about the Divorce Act, although I don't get into it. But when the Divorce Act came in 1969 in the UK, what eventually happened was that not only the few more and more people got divorced, but eventually it switched to fewer and fewer people were getting married in the first place. The whole institution of marriage is completely disintegrated and lost its popularity, or its people don't really necessarily believe it anymore. But that comes back into the cultural issue undermining all of it. And I know plenty of people, women who have been in these relationships where the man, the Peter Pan star man, had not had the sort of courage or not committed. And it's, I guess, it's both the male and the female fault for sticking in these relationships longer than they should have. But maybe they've been misled, or maybe that's unfair of me to judge.
And again, I'm making the mistake probably of talking too much about women. I mean,
I think men have just as much to blame. Yeah. A man that strings a woman along into her 30s for 5-7 years, as you mentioned, and then ends the relationship, they're a dickhead.
Okay. Well, I mean, there's two or three things I think men don't think about. One is that as they age, they're becoming less attractive. Now, men may technically be able to have a child almost any age, but you're competing with a younger version of yourself for the attention of that young woman who's able to have a child. So the fact that you're able to have a child in your 40s, 50s doesn't in any way mean that you've got a greater chance of becoming a parent as a man than a woman. In fact, there's more chance
of that. If I may.
Go on.
And so the dating app, the data from the dating app suggests that the most popular age for a woman from all men is 18. So men always choose younger women, and only because you can't have younger than 18 on the app. And the most popular age for a man is 50 amongst all women, including down to 18-year-olds plus. So I think women do desire up to 50, and that's probably because 50 is peak earning age. So there is a... But where I agree with you is that, firstly, you don't know if you're going to be fertile, and if you don't know what's going to happen in life, anything, you could get killed, you could have cancer, anything could happen that means you no longer have the ability to have children. But then, you're going to disagree with me.
Well, I was going to add to that. I'll let you continue.
But where there is a male biological clock, I think, is that if you want to be a grandfather, if you want to play football with your son, all of these things, you're going to be an old man when, you know, if you're going to be 60 when your kid turns 10, that's yeah, not, if you've, that's, so there is a male biological clock that isn't properly taken serious by men, I think.
Two points. First of all, it may be, I don't dispute your survey, that men can be attracted to 50-year-olds. But the reality is not many 50-year-olds end up marrying, 30, 35-year-olds who still have, they're the exception. Mm-hmm. But a point as well that has come out in conversations with women more than once, if a woman's given the choice of a man who's 40, but never married, no kids, serial relationships, or a divorcee who was a good dad, has two kids, they would choose the divorced dad because he's reliable, perhaps. He committed to a relationship. He's got life experiences. He knows to raise kids.
Mm.
The 40-year-old, I mean, he's got no experiences. He likes dating. Is he going to be a good dad? So this Peter Pan description, you know, is more than just a kitschy way of describing men who don't grow up. Mm-hmm. It's something that I think many women have an aversion to. So that 50-year-old you're describing from a survey, if you actually showed someone, here's a 50-year-old, never married, who's in terms of wealth has got it all together, he may not be quite as attractive in reality on the basis of can he be trusted to be a good father to that woman.
Quite. And do you want to have a relationship where there's such a huge age difference? Some people do. Stephen, that was a very interesting conversation. I'm not sure I'm an optimist, as you've brought in concepts like this leading to war. What I do really appreciate about your work is that you are addressing probably the biggest problem faced by humanity, population collapse. And I implore listeners and viewers to go and watch your film, which I watched on YouTube. And I think there's a second part on your website. If people want to find out more, where can they find you and your work?
I'd love people to come to this website called birthgap.org. We have 4,000 or 5,000 members. There's a lot of information on there. People post some personal stories, some data, some charts. The maps I created showing how this is progressing are all on there. Parts 2 and 3 are on there. They're not fully released to the public yet, but they are viewable on that website. And you can message me there too. Birthgap Part 1, which is called Chalice World, is on YouTube. And I'm on Twitter at Stephen J. Shaw. So I welcome connecting with anybody who's got an interest in this topic.
Well, Stephen, it's been wonderful connecting with you, and thank you for taking the time and carry on the great, great work. And I hope it's great that there's people putting their mind to it, and I hope you can turn it around. Thank you for listening to The Winston Marshall Show with me, Winston Marshall. If you enjoyed that episode, I humbly ask that you like, share, and subscribe. But otherwise, stay tuned. There'll be more coming soon.